Okay, we are lucky that we are limited to Rishon of Kiseitse because the parasha is very packed, but even Rishon is very packed. We'll have a hard time covering everything in the first Aliyah, or all the different themes in the first Aliyah. There's certainly a lot for us to reflect upon this week and also this season, because there are many among the Sifrei Chassidus, but it's actually rooted in the Zohar already, who read interpretations of the psukim that begin the parsha as kind of a metaphor and referring not only to actual physical war with other countries, these opening psukim, Kiseitse l'melchama levecha, but they see here a machlokas with the Yetzirah, and that we should be reminded of the themes, especially as we continue in Elul, we'll make more reference to that in a moment, that as we go out to the Melchama with the Yetzirah, so certain things to be aware of. And the first pasuk talks about the Shavisa Shuvyo. Again, here the literal interpretation is that you've gone out to war and you've come back with a captive. But the idea that if we see this as a reference to tshuva as well, to an internal battle, so you would think, okay, so perhaps you can be successful in your battle against the Yetzer Hara, but you're not going to bring back anything. You're not going to come back with anything more. So the Sefer Mincha Belulah suggests that this is a reference to the notion of tshuva me'ahava, to the idea that the Gemara tells us that there's a level of tshuva. Maybe we'll have an opportunity to talk a little bit more about that as we get closer to Yantif, because it's a very important topic. But that there's a type of tshuva which is greater than the basic level of tshuva. The Gemara calls the basic tshuva, tshuva meira, literally a tshuva that's motivated or that comes from a place of reverence. And that is effective in cleaning the slate, in making our averos into shkagos, making our averos into nothing. But there's a higher madrega, tshuva me'ava, that one can bring a certain attitude and come from a place of avas Hashem and his tshuva. There's a lot to say about that. Hopefully we will find an opportunity to revisit that topic. But that tshuva me'ava is able to actually leave you stronger than you were before. And the Gemara says that it's able to make zidonos shenlo, nasen lo, kizochios, that his averus can turn into mitzvos. That's a very powerful thing. So perhaps that's what's indicated here with this idea of a shavisa shavyo. That's what he wanted to suggest. Rashi right away, the first Rashi and the first words in the first Rashi, understands that this is talking about a melchemes harishus, that this whole din of Yifas Torah is not applicable, not relevant in the context of a Mohammed's mitzvah. Although there is a machlokis about this, the Rambam and the Ramban understand that it is talking about a Mohammed's mitzvah. Many Sfarim talk about the question that if this is talking about Mohammed's Rishus, so there's a kasha from another direction that last week, so we read about the people who go home in the middle of war, people who don't go out to war, and the Gemara explains in Sota, Daf Ben Dalet, that there it's the context of a Mohammed's Rishos, and that this is people who have any kind of averus that they're worried about end up going back home. So the people who are going to go out to fight the Mohammed's Rishos are tzaddikim gemurim, who don't really have anything in their account that's going to get in the way. And yet, that's who we're talking to here. That's who this parsha of Yifas Torah, which we have great, great hesitation about. That's what this parsha of Yifas Torah is addressing. So the people who are such tzaddikim that they don't have anything to go back home for, and yet they're the ones who are going to fall into this situation. So many answers are suggested to this. There's a sefer called Eshkol Yosef, a very interesting sefer. His whole format is he asks a question and then he quotes many different answers. So he's got 9-10 approaches to this. But in many other svarim, they also highlight the fact that this is a statement about the impact of environment. That even if somebody is a tzaddik gomer at home, but when he goes out to war, and he's in a very different context, a very different environment, he may find that his whole attitudes are changed and his whole ability to control himself has changed. And that's a part of what we highlight here in Yeshiva, that we are so grateful for an environment that encourages us to be our best selves and that gives us the framework and the context to do that. And we recognize that while we have Bechira Chavshis and that it's up to us ultimately as individuals to decide what we're going to do and what we're not going to do, but at the same time, the framework has a tremendous impact and the context can have a tremendous effect on how we carry out our genuine aspirations. And that's a very powerful thing to think about. Al piderach hadrush. So again, to go back to some of the Sefer Chasidus, I saw a discussion about this in the Sefer Yunim Ketzarim of Ram Heschel Reisman, that the idea of Mechames HaRashos interpreted al piderach hadrush. So he notes there that part of this fight against the Yetzer Hara can be called the Mechames HaRashos, meaning the war against the idea that everything is basically up to you. That, okay, there are some things that are overt mitzvos, and there are some things that are overt averus, but everything else is basically just optional, and basically just discretionary. And the truth is, it's much more complicated than that. And as the Bar Musar explained, that in all of life situations, there really is a right path and a wrong path. It's not so much of a middle space. It's very personalized. So it takes a lot of wisdom and a lot of self-knowledge and maybe a lot of advice to understand what exactly one's tafkid is and what exactly is the most appropriate thing to be doing at any given moment. But it doesn't mean that it's just up for grabs. And it's an important distinction to understand that there is a tremendous amount of discretion and individuality that's brought to every decision, and everyone's circumstances are unique. So what you do and what path you take is going to be very different than the path the guy next to you takes, and is going to involve a lot of discretion in that sense, that where your Netiyas Halev is the Netziv comments in one place, where you find that you are most inclined to work on, where you feel you're most capable to work on. So there are many, many different drachim, and there are many different answers to this question. But it doesn't mean that it's all just discretionary, that it's all just up to you to decide whether you're going to pursue a productive and a beneficial path or not. So that's an important idea to highlight, and perhaps in a modern context also, this can be applied to the notion that autonomy is a value in and of itself. And the truth is, we have to appreciate that we believe there's autonomy, that one has the right and the responsibility to make the decisions as to where they will best be able to put their kochos and how they will best be able to develop their avoda in this world. But the idea that autonomy separate from anything is an independent value, that's not something that we find within our philosophy over here. And perhaps also al piderach hadrush, the idea that melchemes harishos, the melchama against that idea of rishos, is something that's also very much relevant to our avoda all the time, but especially in Elul. Especially in Elul, because we need to really make sure that we have our values front and center and that we understand what path we're following. And the imagery here of the Eish Tzifas Tzohar is relevant in so many ways, because this next pasuk, and this brings us to some synergy, but we'll see by the time, God willing, we finish this Aliyah, we'll have more synergy. You know, we always look to try to reinforce our lessons during the week to what we find in the parashah and we find in other discussions, so we'll have quite a few very striking opportunities to do that here. But here, this idea, when the Torah tells us what's going on, you will see this Eishu Sifas Torah, and you're going to find, or the person theoretically could feel, that he has a big desire for her. So here's where the Gemara Maseches Kiddushin, and Daf Chaf Aleph Amud Beis, has the famous line that we cited recently in different context, Dibra Torah Keneged Yetzer, that really this is not ideal, and is very far from ideal, and is highly inconsistent with the aspirations of Ben Torah. But we nonetheless have to recognize the power of the Yetzer Hara and that things could be much worse. And therefore, the Torah has to give a context in which to restrain and to limit and to discourage greater involvement in this activity, but saying, okay, if this is going to be, it's going to be only in this very limited context and only because there is this overwhelming force of the Yetzer Hara that's going to otherwise be hard to fight. And indeed, the Ramban, the Torah Tumim, and others say that without that, it's not to be taken as a heter. It's only heter davka because there is this sense that this is the only path in order to prevent worse things from happening. And it's interesting to note also because one could say that how far do you go with this logic of Dibra Torah Keneged Yetzer Hara? So then let's just be matter everything. What exactly is the framework here? So it takes a careful calculation as to what the cost-benefit is, but also, as the Svarim point out, that it's because it's in a context of war, and that context already creates, as we said a minute ago, a very challenging environment where it's going to really be hard to maintain one's standards of behavior and morality. So specifically because it's in such a challenging context, so then we need different strategies. And Reb Simcha Zissel Broyd noted in Sefer Salam Derech, said, you see how challenging it is to keep your focus and to do tshuva and to be a person of Musar, because it's hard to do many things at once. And then when you're fighting on one front, it's very hard to fight on another front. So when you're fighting a physical, actual war, it's going to be very hard to hold on to all of your values, and we have to figure out how exactly you're going to be able to do that.
Who said that?
That was Reb Simcha Zissel Broyd in the Sefer Son Derech. And many make this point about the environment and about the whole nature of Dibra Torah Keneged Yetzer Hara. So we had mentioned it a few weeks ago because it was the view of some of the Rishonim that that's how we relate to the concept of Achilas Basar. We mentioned in Parshas Re'eh and in our learning in Chulin that the Torah's language is hard to understand 100%, and we'll come back to that, whether the Achila of Basar that's permitted from Shrita, is that a neutral? Is that as some maybe understood a mitzvah, or as others understood, maybe it's a concession, maybe it's an example, as some of the Rishonim cite this phrase, of Dibra Torah Keneged Yetzer Hara. So there it's debatable, and there's a whole range. But here, when we talk about the Eishes Tefas Torah, so then it's really clear that certainly this is highly, highly undesirable, highly inconsistent with any kind of a elevated personality. But one could find himself in a situation where Dibra Torah Keneged Yetzer Hara, and this is the least of the bad options. Then there's a lot of discussion in the Rishonim. We won't get into all the details. Machlokas in the Gemara, Machlokas in the Rishonim, how exactly it plays out. The next pasuk says, Ve'veisel soch pesacha, Begilchas roshah, Vasasa sipanea, that there's certain things that are done in order to counteract the attraction. And you know the whole emphasis here. It's interesting because the Torah uses the language of Yufas Torah. And Chazal and Rishonim explained, doesn't mean she's objectively Yufas Torah, it means the person perceives her that way, which you would think is kind of an obvious point, but it's highlighting the fact that the Torah is emphasizing that this is purely a physical attraction, that there isn't anything else that is of a more refined or elevated nature that is driving this, and therefore there's also these details, these actions that are done to counteract that, to try to offset. And it's a big machlokas in the Gemara, machlokas in the Rishonim, about is he allowed to be with her once, and then this is there to stop her from going any further, or to try to focus it, or is this required even before a first time? So that's a debate in the Gemara, it's a debate in the Rishonim. The details of this, there's a lot more to talk about, but that's a topic in and of itself. So then the next pasuk continues, Ve'sira simlas shavya me'aleha, V'yashva v'esecha, uvachsa es aviyya v'asima, yerech yamim, v'acharkin tavayalah uvalta, v'haysalcha l'isha. So here again, there's a lot to talk about in terms of the details, but just to highlight some points. And the Rambam in Hilchas Evel says this idea of crying for her parents for a month It says, based on Yerushalmi, that this is like a smach for the idea of Avelis of Shloshim Yom. We understand Shloshim to be a din de Rabbanan, but this is maybe some kind of a remez to that, that that is the way mourning takes place, that there's a period of a month. But here again, there are other levels that are understood, that it's not just that she is mourning her family members, but she's also giving up her old life with all of its Avodah Zarah and everything that's connected with it. And here the Zohar also connects this again to our own tshuva efforts in very different contexts. And the idea of a month, the Zohar says that's the month of Elul, that that's what we are focusing on right now to try to put ourselves in a place of change, to put ourselves in a place of tshuva. Rav Eliyahu Schlesinger, in one of his farm, so he suggests that the connection to Elul is actually even more direct, that the Pasuk is basically saying that she needs a month in order to acquire new habits, in order to acquire a new perspective on life and a new way of doing things. So too, that's the mentality that we have with Elul, that Elul is about trying to get ourselves in a different frame of mind, in a different path, and that's what this 30-day period is for, which stems with, you know, in the past few years, the psychologists have written a lot about habit formation, and many suggest that it takes 30 days to create a new habit, although they've also pointed out that that's an average. It could be less, it could take much longer, but let's say as a basic average, it takes 30 days to create a new habit. We find that in halacha, though, as Rosh Hashanah also discusses in a sefer, that we know that if you forgot whether you said Mashiv HaRuach or Merit HaGashem, for example, so then we assume that if it's been a month, so then, fine, that's going to be, you can have the assumption that you've taken on a new habit. Because we assume that if you don't remember whether you said it or not, so then we have to look to what your habitual behavior is. So if it's been a month, so then you have a new habit. If it's within a month, so then you're still in the old habits, and you have to assume you didn't say it. So this whole idea that, which again has some support in contemporary psychological studies, that it takes a month to develop a new approach, a new habit, so that's really a more direct connection between what the Pasuk is saying and essentially what Elul is about. Hi, sorry.
I was just about to add, but you pretty much said it, that there's like a bunch of Gemaras that talk about 30 days being a shear of like Sman that allows you to like forget something or take something on.
Right. And yeah, the Gemaras have other numbers also. And right, yeah. That's a whole other discussion. It's actually relevant to this Parsha, but not this Aliyah, in terms of Zechiras HaMalek, the whole discussion. However, that's unfortunately outside of our time parameters for today, but it's an important topic in and of itself. Okay, so yes, there's a lot more to say about this whole idea of Eishes Sifas Toar. You know, the pasuk goes on, V'hayim lo chafatz deba. So here Rashi explains that that's what's likely to happen, that ultimately when the relationship is only based on taiva, so then it's not going to last. After that is initially addressed, so then he's going to lose interest, and that's what we find throughout. That's what the Navi tells us in the context of Amnon and Tamar, that he lost all interest in her afterwards. And all of this is set up to convey that this is very, very b'di'evad, at best, very much not what we're looking for, but in a certain context, this can be the lesser of two evils. Okay, so then the psukim continue with a second topic, but Chazal assume that there is a connection throughout in this aliyah. Question about that?
Quick question. Are there any mafarshim that say that go as far as to leave the Mitzvah Rabbanan?
Now, what's Mitzvah Rabbanan?
Taking out of your process.
So, you know, it's hard to, it's interesting to ask that question because it's important to emphasize that you say Asa Rabbanan, so like if it's necessary, like the Torah is describing, so then it doesn't make sense to ask for midrabanan. If it's anything short of an overwhelming emotional need, physical need, however you want to phrase it, so then it's clearly highly discouraged. So you don't need the Yisud Rabbanan, it's already Asher Min HaTorah in a sense. So it's also important to note, as seen some Sfarim discuss, that Chazal talk about this as an Aveira, even though it's Mutter. So they explain, Baal Musar explain, it can be both. You know, we can say, all right, listen, this is the less bad option here, so we're, so to speak, being matter it, but it's still going to have a tremendously negative impact on the person doing it, negative impact, as we'll discuss, on everything that comes out of this. So it's still something that requires fixing. It's still something that requires addressing. And to put it back in this context of tshuva, and this is very relevant on so many levels to our concept of tshuva as we think about it, as we approach Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, and this deserves much more time, but we'll just say it briefly, that when we think about doing tshuva, really many indications this way, that it's not like there's this checklist that, okay, here's an Avera, do tshuva for this Avera. But really, what tshuva is about fixing the negative spiritual impacts. So that means that theoretically somebody could do tshuva and still be over technical Averas because he has fixed a deficit, while it also means the opposite, that a person, and it very much means the opposite, that a person could be, technically speaking, not violating any actionable items on the Avera list, but still very much in need of tshuva, very much in need of spiritual repair. And so I think it's important to highlight your question, whether you want to call it Nisad Rabbanan. You know, very often we say that, and this is itself a discussion, it goes back to last week's parsha, Parsha Shoftim, but the whole, it gives us an opportunity to fill in, that last week we mentioned, I think, that the Rambam learns the source for rabbinic authority and for the reason to observe Dinim D'Rabbanan from last week's parsha, from L'Sasum and Adalver, and the Rambam disagrees for a lot of reasons. So I don't think we got a chance to address the question that if the Rambam doesn't approve of using that pasuk, and the nature of his questions was that he doesn't approve of using any pasuk, would come to that conclusion, he can't use any pasuk as the source for Dinim D'Rabbanan. So why do we observe Dinim D'Rabbanan? Why did the Ramban observe Dinim D'Rabbanan if it doesn't come from any source within the Chumash itself? So many understand that the impact of a Dinim D'Rabbanan is to convey to us the Ratzon HaTorah even without a pasuk. So that what we understand that there is a message the Torah is conveying, even if it's not formulated as a mitzvah d'oraisa, then that creates an obligation upon us, as Rosh Hashanah likes to explain it. Says that you're able to read between the lines, and those who know the lines very well, the Rabbanim know the lines very well, so they know how to read between the lines. They know how to understand what the Ratzon HaTorah is. So here it's explicit, you know, that the Ratzon HaTorah is that this is not going to happen. So certainly one who's able to adhere to that is going to appreciate that, and you don't need a formal Issur D'Rabbanan. Okay. So just to take a look at this next section, which I will have to figure out how much time we have for all the different things here. But the next pasuk continues that you could have somebody with two wives. Kisiyan alish shtei nashim ha'achas ahuva v'achas nua v'yol delavonim ha'huva v'achas nua v'haya ha'ben ha'bechor l'sniya. An interesting grammatical question. Rebecca Kamenetsky and others talk about why the pasuk switches here from snua to snia. He has Rebecca Kamenetsky's svarim are always fascinating because he was a master of all aspects of Torah. So he knew Shas, but he knew Tanakh inside outside. He knew Diktuk inside and outside. He knew everything in Torah Shavuch Zav and Torah Shabbat Peh. So he focuses often on grammar and on trop, and together with all kinds of other aspects of Torah. So he discusses some of the grammatical questions that come up from this pasuk. But it's also interesting that the Chidah and others comment as well that maybe there's a remez here to the whole story of Yaakov, and that Yaakov had more than one wife, and he had firstborns from each, and he essentially preferred the younger firstborn. He preferred the firstborn of Rachel to the chronological firstborn of Reuven, and that had very negative consequences, of Reuven being the firstborn of Leah, and that had very negative consequences, and a lot emerged from that favoritism. So on some level, this pasuk can be read as being a remez to that story as well, if I remember correctly. I think Rabbi David Foreman wrote an article about that once, about the parallels between this psukim and that story. And there's a lot to consider about what exactly is going on here. We talk about Ahuva and Snua. Sounds pretty horrible that one would be married to a woman and one would hate her. So it's a good question what exactly the word means in this context. The Gemara suggests that it actually means not that he hates her, but it has to do with the halachic status of the marriage, that even if somebody would marry someone be'isser, so it's Snua b'nisu'eha, still, this din applies that the actual oldest bechor is the bechor, even if it comes from one whose marriage is halachically frowned upon. Remember once hearing a lecture from Professor Zubin Zichron Lebracha, who pointed out, based on other indications, that the language of sinah that you sometimes find in the Torah doesn't necessarily mean affirmative hatred, but it means that which is not prioritized. So in contrast, relative contrast to Ahava, and there's room to discuss the definition of Sinas Chinam based on that. Sinas Chinam doesn't necessarily mean a person is irrationally, pathologically hating other people, but that Yisam doesn't prioritize proper attention in the relationship. So in any event, the Torah describes here that you could have such a situation where you want to prefer the younger Bechor over the older Bechor, and we're not allowed to do that. That's its own problem. Just here, it's also noteworthy, especially when we talk about Ratzon HaTorah. So there is a discussion, Chassam Sofer has a tshuva, when he asks upon this, that here the Torah is clearly describing, as we know already, but we know this from other contexts, where the Torah is spelling it out, that it's possible to have two wives. And the Torah is not criticizing that. It's just saying that that's going to impact how you decide about the Bechor, but it's not saying anything about not having two wives. So the Chassam Sofer asks on this that there is a Taz. Taz actually appears in three places in Shulchan Aruch, and it's a very often quoted Taz, so much so that Reb David Cohn wrote a sefer about this Taz, and he entitled the sefer HaTaz HaYadua, the famous Taz. So what's the famous Taz? The Taz says the Yisod, about which there's also a lot more to say, that even though we know that Chazal, when they make Dinim D'Rabbanan, so they add on to what's existing in the Torah, they're prohibiting things that weren't otherwise prohibited. So we understand that the things that Chazal prohibit were not prohibited by the Torah. But the Taz says they're not allowed to prohibit things that the Torah explicitly permits. So if the Torah says that it's mutter, so then they can't come and add on to it. Now it's interesting to clarify why that is. Rav Shechter often explains that it's because the Torah Shebichsav and the Torah Shebalpeh, they all become one entity. So you can't have contradictions within it. It can't be that the Torah Shebichsav is saying it's okay, and the Torah Shebalpeh is saying it's not okay. I could also reflect what we said a minute ago, that the idea of the Ratzon HaTorah, that if the whole point is that Chazal are able to discern what the Ratzon HaTorah actually is, it becomes harder to believe it's the Ratzon HaTorah if the Torah says that it's okay. And again, that's why we had to explain in the previous context that it's clearly not presented as a desirable kind of action. But in this context, Chassam Sofer asks, so how could Rabbeinu Gershom come and prohibit marrying two wives if the Torah is telling us it's okay? So he assumes that it doesn't apply to takanas. It doesn't apply to that which is made as a societal protection or societal improvement. It's important also to understand the whole nature of this Cherem Rabbeinu Gershom, not to marry two wives. In general, so I'm asking a question from another direction, because Rabbeinu Gershom made this policy, he made this Cherem. So there's a whole discussion in general what a Cherem is. Now, when we find that, whether it's Rabbeinu Gershom or earlier Chachamim, later, who make a Cherem, so there's a lot to discuss. Does that mean that, oh, until they came along, it was mutter, and they came and declared it usher? So there's a lot of room to say it doesn't mean that. And again, to quote Rav Shechter, Shechter often comments that it doesn't mean that it was permissible until they made the cherem, and now all of a sudden it newly became prohibited. A cherem is a klal, a cherem is essentially a curse. It's a way of putting a very strong disapproval on a certain behavior, and presumably it means that people were doing it even though it was already prohibited, and the rabbinic leadership found the need to make a big statement about it and to make a cherem, but it's not to infer from there that it was completely fine before this. It was bad before this, and for whatever reason, the rabbinic leadership had to take a strong stance against it. So, as you would point out, so reading somebody's mail without their permission, or divorcing one's wife without her permission. So these are examples of cherem de Rabbeinu Gershom. So they were totally fine until he came along. Now that was always wrong to do. And Rabbeinu Gershom came and made it a big social sanction to stop people from doing it. So then the question becomes, but what about marrying two wives? You're going to tell me that that was always awesome whatsoever? It doesn't sound like it. So presumably what we have to understand about that is that there's a number of different components to such an action. That if a man would marry more than one wife, we could look at it from a few directions. You could look at it from the direction of Eben HaEzer. So we have very strict halachos of relationships and adultery and the like. So from the perspective of Eben HaEzer, so yes, it's true that the Torah does permit a man to marry more than one wife and does not permit a wife to marry more than one man. And that also reflects various implications in terms of yichus and the family structure and the like. But there are other concerns. So there's a ben adam l'chavero concern that if a spouse of any type were to take on another spouse, so that's a tremendous betrayal of the existing spouse, and particularly in a society where that's the expectation. So if one was living in a society where every man had multiple wives, and a wife who gets married to this man, she understands that's the nature of how the society is set up, and it's not going to be a betrayal for the husband to take on another wife. Okay, so then it's technically speaking conceivable. And still, probably not ideal, but it's a different discussion. But if you have a society where the understanding is that everybody is only going to marry one spouse, so then for the man to take on another spouse, that's a tremendous ben adam l'chavero betrayal of his existing wife. So you don't need to... You don't need extra sources to understand that that is a violation of Torah values. But apparently, Rabbeinu Gershom saw that people thought this was okay anyway, so he had to make a strong stance that, no, this isn't some new problem. This would always be wrong. Living in a culture where there's one spouse per person, so it's for a man to say, okay, it's fine for me to take on another wife because the Torah doesn't object. No, the Torah would object to that. That would be a terrible betrayal. And therefore, he put a cherem to make that point. There are those who suggest that the reason Rabbeinu Gershom was referred to as Mor HaGola, who was the light of the exile, is that he basically saved the Jewish people in the exile. Because they say that here, if the Jews are exiled because they have been misbehaving, so they have tampered with the, so to speak, marital relationship between the Jewish people and God, as we find the mashal often used. So what's God's options here? If the Jewish people aren't behaving properly, so he could divorce them, bal karchem, or he could take on another nation and say, okay, the Jews are still a chosen people, but I got another chosen people that's going to be better. So Rabbeinu Gershom made a takana, because Baruch Hu signs on, that no, you can't do that, you can't divorce your spouse, bal karchem, you can't take on another spouse against their will, so God stays with us. So Rabbeinu Gershom is the Mor HaGola. He is the one who enlightens the exile. He's the one who keeps us on track. Okay, so, but we didn't read what you're not allowed to do in terms of the situation. The next pasuk says, "Kias habachar ben hasnua yakir lo seislo pishnayim b'chol asher yimatzei lo ki hu reishis ono lo mishpat habachar." So okay, so you have to give the nachla to the pishnayim nachla to the actual Bechor, and you're not allowed to change that around. Okay. The previous pasuk, which uses the phrase al-pene, it's an interesting discussion what exactly that means, the context of al-pene. The Ramban has a chiddush halacha based on this, that it says it means that the Bechor is alive. So if the Bechor is alive, then you can't decide that you're going to prefer the younger child. But let's say the Bechor is no longer alive, and now his extra Nachala would have passed to his descendants, so then you can move around the extra portion and disfavor the children of the Bechor. And the Sefer Ksava HaKabbalah, so he has another interpretation there. The way he understands Al Panei is that Panei means that working with the Ratzon of the person, and Al means in this context that it is against the will of the person. So essentially what the Pasuk is saying is that you can't move around the inheritance here to give the extra portion to the other child against the will of the actual Bechor. But if the actual Bechor is okay with it, if he agrees with it, so then it could be tolerated. It's a whole grammatical discussion, how exactly to understand Al Panei. And the Torah Tamimi has a discussion about this. I saw in my grandfather's commentary to the Torah Tamimi in the Meshivas Nafesh, he has a lot of discussion about whether this is used one way throughout the Torah Al Panei, or is it used in different meanings in different contexts. And he quotes this Aksava HaKabbalah and discusses some of these interpretations. Okay, so then this brings us to a huge topic, a very difficult topic. So let's say you have a son who is rebellious. How exactly do you translate the term sorer mora? I understand it to mean rebellious. If you look in Unklus, it says sate umori. I think also in other versions it says morate. So Nisate means he wanders off, he's off the derech, literally, he's in the wrong direction, and he is rebellious. In the Sifrei, they have a different version, that it says, Umore, Zmore la'atzmo, derech acheres, that he allows himself, he tells himself that he can take a different path, and they go together, that if your direction is in the wrong way, so then you also are biased in terms of telling yourself what to do, and they impact each other. The idea that you will choose your own behavior based on what you think is appropriate, that's only going to work if you're facing the right direction, and that's going to have its own impact. It's very much a part of this whole story of the Ben Sora Mora. And this Meshuvas Nefesh also points out that if you look in the Mora Nevuchim, this whole idea of sati that Sifrei has here, that you're going to, it's like the same word as sote, sometimes spelled with a sin and sometimes spelled with a samach. So it looks, when it's spelled with a sin, it looks like shote, like a person is mentally compromised, but really it's with a sin, not a shin, so it means somebody who is wayward. So the person who is wayward is going to be more derech to himself in a very negative passion. And the Mor Nevuchim, the Rambam explains that that's the shoresh of the word satan, that the satan leads you astray, and that's the whole nature of the concept. So here, this is a difficult idea, the Ben Sora Mora, and the Gemara has a statement, Amar in Sanhedrin, Daf Ayin Aleph, that says this is among the things that never actually happened in the real world. That Ben Saramora Lahaya Blasilios, that has never happened and is never going to happen. But Mar also records another opinion that Rabbi Yochanan says, "Oh, I'm aware of one. I saw one, and I sat on his grave." And the Gemara also says, in that context, that Yer Hanidachas Lahaya Blasilios, that the details of the Yer Hanidachas are too impossible to ever come together, and that's never going to happen. So Rabbi Yochanan says, "Oh, I saw one also, and I saw its ruins." So some Svarim they discuss, so that Rav Schwab and Sefer and Chumash and Rav Ruderman, they recently published some of the Sichos of Rav Ruderman, the founding Rashi of Nei Yisrael. They have very similar approaches to this whole discussion. Like Rav Schwab puts it, that Rabbi Yochanan is so lucky that he's the only one who happened to run into both a Ben Sora Mora's grave and the remnants of an Yer HaNidachas. So one opinion of the said never happened anywhere. And he's like, "Oh yeah, though I happen to have seen both." So how likely is that? So they both say along the same direction that they're really not disagreeing, that the details that are necessary in order for these halachos to be carried out are close to impossible, maybe even actually impossible, depends what you focus on, for them to actually come together in the real world. So it's credible that this never actually was carried out. But there's a value system that we're going to talk about in a minute that is conveyed, and the Torah is saying that essentially, for example, in the case of the Ben Tzor Ma'ariv, we'll say more about, there's a reality that is going to lead to very negative consequences. And when that does happen, because of real-world factors, you can look back and you can see that essentially it's because that was going on, it's because we had a genuine Ben Tzor Ma'ariv. So essentially the positions are not really disagreeing. It's saying as far as that Beis Din actually carrying out what these psukim describe, maybe that never happened and never will happen. But as far as the real-world impact that is the basis for what we're about to read here, that unfortunately does happen. That's what Rabbi Yochanan was saying, that he saw that the concepts exist even if the halachos aren't carried out that way.
If the real-world consequences are real, I mean, really do care about them. Mm-hmm. It's real that we're so, like, we make it so impossible for it to actually happen to carry the punishment.
All right, so let's talk about that for a second. So the Gemara asks, after saying this, that it never happened, so the Gemara asks, so im kein lama nichtava, so why does the Torah give us mitzvos that are not practical, which is an interesting discussion in some other contexts also. But the answer the Gemara gives there is drosh v'kabel schar, that don't worry about it, darshan it, and you will get schar for the drosha. So it's a little bit of a surprising statement, because we know that there's enough halacha l'maisa to occupy us for our whole lives, that if we just need to get schar Talmud Torah, and we need to find good things to learn about, there's no shortage. So why does the Torah need to include extra things that are not relevant to the real world, and tell us that, well, learn it and get schar for learning it? So there are various approaches to this. The Ramban in general has an approach that the whole Torah, mystically, is a mashal for HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and it expresses itself in halachic principles. And 99% of the mashal is able to be expressed in terms of things that actually do happen. And a small percentage of the mashal is expressed in terms of things that don't actually take place. But it's still a part of the Torah, because it's our path through the halacha to understanding the essence of the HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, Zohar Yisrael, so he explained that this was in order to help us appreciate the value of Torah study itself, and not to focus only on that which is connected to practical behavior. It's a delicate point, because we do believe that the Torah study for the Amanas Lasos, in order to practice, is very important. We talk about being Sukei Shmaisa Liba Dehochasa, which also is a measurement of just how thorough your learning is, that you understand the dinim to the point where you know what the practical conclusions would be. It's not necessarily only about practice, but we do have a focus and a recognition of the importance of learning practical halacha, but we also have to be able to appreciate that the Torah study is valuable separate from that also. So to have this small minority of the Torah exist in that space, he understood, was important for that message, and it's consistent with an idea the Beis HaLevi had. Beis HaLevi expresses this idea in at least three places. You can find this in the Hakdamah to the Shilas and Shuvas. He says this word, and he also says it in the Shuvas in some above, and he also says this in his commentary to Chumash. So what's this? What's the idea? It says that we know that the Gemara tells us in Shabbos and Daf Peches that a big credit to the Jewish people is that we said Nasa v'Nishma. That was something that was so impressive that the angels came down from Shemayim and they gave two crowns to every Jew for saying Nasa v'Nishma. So we normally understand that to mean that the Jews were so enthusiastic to accept the Torah that they didn't even have to hear what it was. They were willing to accept it right away, jump in, Nasa, we'll take it, we'll do it, and then maybe afterwards we'll hear the details. Nishma. So the truth is, it's a little hard to understand why that's such a milo, because we do believe in being rational in our decisions. So what if you jump in without knowing what's involved? Why is that a milo? So essentially the Rav had a drasha about this that was printed in the Reflections of the Rav, but his great-grandfather, who was named after the original Yosef Dov Soloveitchik, the Beis HaLevi, had a different mahalach in his farm, and the Beis HaLevi said that clearly you would have to learn details in order to practice the mitzvot. So it's not shy to practice the mitzvot without knowing something. So really, when we say Nasa, we're going to do the mitzvot, we really mean that we're going to learn first and then do the mitzvot. So by saying Nasa v'nishma, what we're really saying is Nishma v'nasa v'nishma. That we're going to learn so that we'll know what to do. We'll do. And then we'll still learn afterwards. That there's still a value in learning even after we already know. So he says that's why the whole imagery of two crowns. Why two crowns? Okay, so we were all impressive. We deserve one crown. So what's pshat in two crowns? So the Beis Halevi explained that had the Jews said Nishma v'nasa, that would have been one Kabbalah. It was okay, we're willing to accept the Torah and we'll learn what we need to do and then we'll carry it out. That's one idea. But because they said the other order, they said Nasa v'nishma, so it made it into two things. Nasa, Nishma v'nasa, we'll learn in order to do, and we'll also learn separate from what we have to do. So there's a value, like the Rabbi Shmuel Salanter was saying, there's a value to having mitzvahs in the Torah that don't affect our practical decisions because it helps us to appreciate that aspect of Talmud Torah. But it's also just interesting because here the Gemara says that drosh v'kabel schar, so we talk about drosha in the modern sense and we get homiletic lessons and inspiration from things. So clearly it has that value, that this parsha of the Torah, even if we're not actually carrying this out, has messages for us to learn, homiletic messages. So drosh v'kabel schar, get the value of saying drushes on this din. That's very much the case. There is a lot that is derived from these psukim, and a lot that's derived from the whole concept of Ben Sora and Mara. Just to highlight a few, it's really very significant in what it has to say about the nature of chinuch, and a lot to darshan from that perspective. So one of the reasons why it's considered to be incredibly unlikely or maybe even impossible for there to be a Ben Sora and Mara is that the parents come and they claim that this boy, he doesn't listen to us. So he doesn't listen to our voice. So the Gemara understands that they have to speak in the same voice. They have to have identical voices. So, Einu Shomei V'Koleinu Pasuk Chaf, our mutual voice. So it seems like a very difficult technical detail to obtain. But in the sense of Rosh V'Kabel Schar, we can understand what it means, that if the parents don't speak in one voice, if the parents are sending contradictory messages, so then you can't blame the boy for not knowing what to do. You can't blame him for being rebellious and confused because the parents are sending inconsistent messages. So the Torah is saying this concept only makes sense when the parents do speak in one voice and they're giving a consistent message, and nonetheless the child is going to be rebellious, so then there's what to talk about. So one example of where you find this idea of drosh v'kabel schar. It's also related that Chazal tell us, the Gemara says in Sanhedrin and Daf Kuv Zayin, and Rashi quotes it, that the juxtaposition here, it's not exact juxtaposition, but the third topic is connected to the first topic in the Saliya, that we have Yifas Torah and then we have Ben Sora Morah, because that's going to be a result, that when somebody gets involved in a Yifas Torah, so then the result is they're going to have a Ben Sora Morah. So it's an interesting question. If we say never was a Ben Sora Morah, does that mean never was a Yifas Torah? I don't know how to do the math on that one, but maybe. But in any event, the nature of the relationship is also a source for Musar. So here, as Rav Gifter pointed out in his comments, also B'Leo Schlesinger has a comment about this also, that when children see that the parents act without any restraint, without any kind of self-control, so that's going to have an impact on the chinuch. That's going to create a model in the household that the child's going to follow that. He's going to say, why should I be in control if the parents, if the adults are not able to be people who are restrained and disciplined? So then, why should I be? So that's also going to have a very negative effect. Rav Moshe Feinstein, in his comments on Chumash, he has a little bit of a different twist on that. And he says that the whole approach of saying, when we talk about Dibra Torah Keneged Yetzirah, so we're saying essentially, this is really something the Torah doesn't like, but we have a heter in this situation. So it says that whole mentality that if a parent is conveying the image that, well, okay, we have these halachic constraints and they make us unhappy, so we have to figure out how to get a heter, how to undo them. So then what the child sees is that Torah is very unpleasant, that the life of the Torah is not something desirable, and it's not something they're going to want to follow. And so he gives the example, if the parents create the impression that Shmir Shabbos is incredibly difficult, they do it because they feel obligated to follow the rules, but they find it to be incredibly burdensome, and they're going to do whatever they can to find a way out. So the child gets the message that, okay, that's what the Torah is like. It's very unpleasant, and the parents are always looking for a way out, even though they felt committed. So why should I be committed? Why should I do it? It's something that I don't want. So that's also going to be a result of this kind of approach. And this is consistent. Rav Moshe Feinstein has this idea all over his comments of Chumash. The biography is quoted to make this point, so many of his comments in Chumash, if you read through, you see it's consistent with this idea that Rav Moshe was quoted often as saying that we ruin our children by saying Shver Tzayin Yid. Then we say that it's hard to be a Jew, and you say that, what can I do? I live this life, but it's difficult. So the children hear that, and they say, okay, so who needs to live this life? They abandon the whole thing. So Moshe was always very critical, and again, you can just find it as a theme that comes up again and again in his comments on Chumash, that if that's the message the parents convey, so then the children will say, so forget it, so who needs it? So you have to be very aware of that, and so here in this context it's saying that if the attitude is, okay, how can I find a way to not adhere to the values of the Torah system, so then the children will get that message. There's another point here which I think is very important to emphasize, that the idea, the parents have the right to be mochel on this whole issue. So this is only happening because the parents have assessed a situation like this and they're coming and bringing him to Beis Din. So one could also add to the chinuch messages that this whole terrible fate that the Torah predicts and Chazal explained, because they understand that he's going to go down a very negative path, and we'll talk more about that in a second. Why is that true? It's true if the parents give up on him. If the parents say that, forget about it, so then that's going to be a very bad future for him. But if the parents maintain a belief in the child and they maintain involvement and they believe that they can continue to have an impact, so then this whole concept shouldn't come up. And in the context also of the rebellion and not listening to him, one could suggest that one of the yetzaharas a parent could have to give up on the child is because they're very makbid on their own covet, you know, that they say, okay, he doesn't listen to me, so there's no hope for him. He's rebellious, and he doesn't know how to be nice to me, he doesn't know how to be respectful to me. So that's a part of what might motivate a parent to say, okay, I'm not going to invest any more hope in him. But if a parent maintains belief in the child's ability to turn around and doesn't want to see this kind of a future, so then the whole concept of Ben Torah Mora perhaps doesn't have the relevance. But the whole idea, it's interesting to note that Dean Eichler wrote an article many years ago in the Mitoch HaOhel, where he compared the idea of Ben Torah Mora to some of what you found in cultures around the time of the Torah, Hammurabi's Code and others, and he pointed out that in many cultures at that time, if the parents wanted to, they could just kill their children. If they decided that they were unhappy with how their children were, they could decide to kill them. So what the Torah is telling us here is the Torah is highly restricting it, is saying only under these circumstances is that going to be an appropriate path. And what I feel is noteworthy about that approach is that, first of all, it makes it very similar to Yeshua Tifas Torah, and since Chazal and the juxtaposition of the Torah has already linked Eishes Sifas Torah and Ben Sora Mora, so it's a similar idea, saying that this is something that may happen in the outside world, but the Torah is saying only under very limited and very precise circumstances. It also is consistent with the attitude of Chazal here, because Chazal interpreting the Psukim to be so narrow and restrictive in terms of how this could happen is along those same lines, then, that essentially we're saying that this was something people in the ancient world thought they could do. They could execute their children on their own decisions. And the Torah is saying, no, that there's only a very, very specific and irreversible kind of situation, or apparently irreversible kind of situation, that could justify that. So in terms of the irreversibility, so Chazal explained that whatever this boy has done until now is not so terrible, is not something that could justify being executed. So he took a little bit of meat, he took a little bit of wine. Why is that something that you're chayiv misa for? So the Gemara explains it's because he's nidoin al shem sofo, that essentially his future is going to be much, much worse. If this is how he's starting at this young age, so then it's going to be a very bad result, and he's going to end up doing much worse things. So better off that we stop things at this point rather than let him be the menace to society that he is destined to be in light of what we've said so far. If he's abandoned by his parents, have given up on him and said that he's too rebellious to have any potential, so then it's going to end up getting worse and worse, and so better off that he... pay the price now, rather than it's not even from paying the price, it's from stopping him from becoming the menace society that he was ultimately going to become. So many ask the question that this idea of Nidon al Shem Sofo is against a value that we have, that we understand that people are judged by Asher Husham, that that's a pasuk in Bereishis, where the Torah is talking about Yishmael, that the Torah says that Yishmael's life was at risk out there in the wilderness, but Hagar prayed for him, and he was saved. The Torah says, "V'yishmas kol hanar ba'asher husham," that his voice was heard ba'asher husham. And that idea, ba'asher husham, so Chazal tell us that the Malach HaShari said to Ribono Shalom, said, "Why are you saving this guy? He's going to, his descendants, everything's going to be terrible that's going to come from this person. There's going to be a lot of bad things that are going to happen in the future from Yishmael and from those who come from him." So Chazal relate that his response was, but what is he right now? He's a tzaddik right now, so therefore doesn't deserve to die right now. So we only judge people by Asher Husham. So the question is, so does this not contradict the idea of Nidoin al Shem Sofo? So many explain that when we talk about judging somebody in the future, there's two different kinds of future. That if we have a crystal ball or we have Ruach HaKodesh, we have the ability to look at the future. And we say, right now this guy is innocent, but in the future he's going to do terrible things. Then it's not fair to bring his future into now. But if it's not based on just having some kind of advanced information, but it's because you look at where the person is holding right now, and you see that he's on a path that is just going to get worse and worse, so then it may be legitimate to look into that as a part of the judgment. I think this is an idea that's very relevant to the whole notion of tshuva. Halachically, the Chasam Sofer has this kind of mahalach when he talks about that sometimes in halacha we have a format that we say, kala omeid to something, ke something dummy, that anything that ultimately is going to reach a certain state, we look at it as if it's in that state already. So what does that mean? We always just look at the future, we don't look at what is now. It presumably means that if it's a natural process, it's going to go from A to B, so then it's as if it's already at B. But if it's something's going to intervene to change the status, then we don't look at that as if that's happened now. So here, Yishmael, okay, there was a future, something different is going to happen, but with the Ben Saramora, the process is already started. So I think this is very crucial for Hilchus Tshuva, because the Rambam has a very daunting statement when he talks about the requirement for Tshuva. He says, what's the standard for Tshuva? He says, a person is considered a Baal Tshuva when at Sheyoyed Olav Yedea Talumas, when the one who knows the secrets, meaning the Ribono Shlalom, is able to testify about this person that he's not going to go back to the Aver. So that's a very demanding standard. So are we saying that if somebody is 20 years old, and he does tshuva for something, and he has every ounce of charata and sincerity you could possibly imagine, and he goes to shul in Yom Kippur and does everything he's asked to, and for 50 years he's a tzaddik gomer, and then at age 70 he has another nisayon, he ends up doing it again. So that's not tshuva when he was 20? Is that really fair to say that we have to be able to have confirmation from the one who knows everything that it's never going to happen again. So I think what probably Pshat is, I recently saw, I think Ramesh Sternbach has a similar approach, that we're not talking about the Yodea Talumas in the sense of God knows the future. We're talking about the Yodea Talumas that God knows perfectly what's going on right now. So the question is, when a person is claiming to have done tshuva, is he only holding his breath until after Yom Kippur and then he's going to go right back to what he was doing? Or has he really done the internal avoda, and like we said before, the whole 30-day process of Elul, where we're seeking to really change habits and change attitudes, has he really changed into something different internally? So the Odeya Talumas is there to testify, Kadosh Baruch Hu is there to testify that knowing what's inside the individual right now, he's not likely to go right back to the same Avera. If 50 years from now there's another Nesayan, that's a whole different story. That's not what we're talking about now. We're talking about knowing the inner reality, having perfect knowledge of the present. That may be relevant to this question of whether he has actually done tshuva. So in terms of this whole stira or contradiction between Yishmael and the Ben Sora Mora, the Reshiv Karen B. Avner of Goldbach has some beautiful essays about this, which also relate to some of the themes of Rosh Hashanah. So maybe as we get closer to Rosh Hashanah, I'll refer back to this. Maybe that'll be a little synergy because it's a little bit beyond our time scope right now, but he draws on the whole nature of Yishmael and the Tefillah and how that contrasts with the Ben Sora Mora. So remember that if we come back to the Rosh Hashanah time. But also in his Sefer, the Sumas Marachos, also here in the Kiseitse, there he, that other point he discusses also in the Sfarim in Rosh Hashanah, there's a lot to talk about that, but he also has another piece in Kiseitse where he adds to this that among the very specific details that we have about the Ben Sora Mora is that he has to steal food from his father and eat it somewhere else. But if he stole it and ate it in his father's house, or if he stole it from somewhere else and ate it in his father, then it's not going to be among the very precise details for Ben Sora Mora. So Chazal explained, Shonim explained, that if he eats it in his father's house, he stole it and he's still eating it in his father's house, where his father can show up at any minute. So he's always going to be afraid. He's always going to have pachad that he can get caught, and that's not what we're talking about here. So the Shiva said, what do you mean? That's worse, right? It's a bigger mechutzah. If he's doing it in the father's house where he could get caught, so then you should say that's a bigger rebellion. So he said, no, that what we're concerned about here is we're concerned that this is going to become a constant tendency. So when a person feels that there's nothing inhibiting him, so say, nice and look ahead there, so that it becomes like something he thinks is completely permitted, and it becomes something that he's going to do in an ongoing kind of way. But if when he's committing this act, he feels pachad, he feels that uneasy, that he could get caught at any minute, so that's not going to be something which is going to have that kind of a imprint on his personality. So this idea that it's something which is going to affect his future, in that kind of scenario, he thought that that's what the Chazal meant. It's not going to have that same impact. Of course, it does transition in the middle when people do things like this constantly, so then they have begin to get a bigger tolerance for risk and they don't feel the same pachad ultimately, but essentially that the mentality is what the Reshiva is highlighting. So it's also important to point out before we run out of time, but there here we have a major synergy opportunity which we cannot miss. So let's quickly get this in before Mincha. So the Rambam in Sefer HaMitzvahs, so in Kuf Tzadi Hei, so he cites this as an Isser. That what's the Isser from Ben Sora Mora? That there is an Isser to be Zolo V'Soyvei. That there is an Isser to act in the undisciplined way that the Ben Sora Mora does. And he says if there's a punishment here, there's got to be a Azhara somewhere. There's got to be an Isser for him to act that way. So he says he uses the phrase Zolo V'Soyvei. To act like that is the Isser. But what's the source? That he quotes from the Gemara that the source is connected to Leisoch L'Ol Adam. Now, L'Sochel Adam is a difficult pasuk because there are many different interpretations, many, it's a whole long list. That's why we really call it a lav shiva klolos. It means that it's a prohibition that doesn't have an onesh, but usually, and this is the exception because the Torah highlights what happens, but otherwise we'd say there's no malchus associated with L'Sochel Adam because it has so many different interpretations. So one of the interpretations is that you shouldn't eat in a way that gets you executed, that gets you bloody, that gets your blood spilled. So what's eating in a way that's going to get you chayiv misa? So acting in this unrestrained way of the zolo v'soveh, That's what's going to bring you to that point. And the Sefer HaChinuch writes, this is a general Isser, it's defined over here, and the Sefer HaChinuch writes that the Torah commands this at the beginning of adolescence, this very narrow time period, among all the other details. It only applies right after godless, only for a few months. So until he's a full adult, then he's not in his parents' rishus anymore anyway. And when he's too young, so he shouldn't be subject to onshin, as we've been discussing. It's a very narrow window when this applies. But in terms of the concept of not being a zol of the sovei, so let's say for Achinuch writes that the Torah conveys this at this point when the hormones, when the taivas are the greatest, so that we should understand from there all the more so that this is something we have to be very careful about. So here for the super synergy, so to say for Hagus B'Mikra, which is a soft cover pamphlet, but they have sichos from Rav Aryeh Malkiel Kotler, and he has discussion and he quotes a lot from his grandfather, from Rav Aryeh Kotler in the Mishnah Shavi Aaron. He says that essentially what the Zolov L'Savei represents is the opposite of the ultimate refined Jew, of the Kedoshim Tiyu, of the person who does all of his Gashmius L'Shem, the Ruchnius, and this is the opposite. This is the very pure Gashmius Taiva kind of personality. And he contrasts it with, you can probably guess, with our discussion from Parshas Re'eh about the Heter to eat Basar and our whole Masechta and all of the Hashgafic themes of the Masechta. And he notes that Bechlal, interesting, that Moshe Rabbeinu essentially gives up on the Jewish people when they ask for basar. And yet, later on, the Torah tells us how to eat basar. So Moshe Rabbeinu's frustration with the Jewish people is they disdain the man, and they want instead basar. And we know the man could taste like anything. The man has these unbelievable qualities, could taste like whatever you want. So it was able to provide the benefit for somebody who's looking to elevate Gashmius into a part of his avoda, so the man was set up for such a approach. But the Jews were just simply at that time saying, "Where it's bali taiva, we're just interested in the meat. We're not interested in that kind of a spiritualized eating." So Moshe Rabbeinu essentially said, "I can't deal with this." But when the Torah essentially then says, "Here is the heter achilas basar," like we discussed, and it's interesting to reflect also upon the point of the Lubav Jerevi in terms of how we compared the man to the basar that's described in the pasuk. So then the point was that when you're able to bring this mentality of elevating the gashmius, so then, okay, that's the legitimate approach to basar as opposed to what they were saying at that point. And that essentially, so for some super synergy here, so what we're finding is that the Zolol de Savei, the Ben Sar Gorer, is the polar opposite of the mentality of Maseches Chulin that we're trying to emphasize. So all of the themes that we discussed in these past few weeks is highlighted in the opposite extreme by the Ben Sar Gorer, and that's one of the major messages that we take away, that we have to keep these perspectives, keep these ideas very much a part of our consciousness as we seek to define our personality over the course of El and Yom HaDin. I wish everyone a wonderful Shabbos. God willing, on Sunday we'll discuss some important themes. Hopefully everybody will be here for that, and everybody will be able to be. And we wish everyone a wonderful Shabbos. Should be only good things. Okay.